The viewpoints expressed in the following program are not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. The following program contains subject matter and realistic language that some listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Well, good afternoon, Savannah. It is just past 12 o'clock on this Friday, and that means you're now listening to Literature with Lee and PT. Now, here at Listening to Literature, we like to examine thought-provoking books of the present and the past. And PT, I think we have a thought-provoking book from about almost 70 years ago now.
Oh, boy, do we ever. Right. This is a book I ran into very much earlier than it is now. And what amazes me about it is it's not only still correct and insightful, but it seems even more relevant now than it did back then.
It has pretty much lasted its 70 years time frame. So it's Eric Hoffer's The True Believer, which was originally published in 1951. Now, The True Believer does have a subtitle. It is called The True Believer, Thoughts on the Nature of Mass Movements by Eric Hoffer.
And that in itself is a clue to what you're going to hear. Now, a lot of people who write books like this have a specific mass movement in mind. If they're on the left, they're looking at conservatives. If they're on the right, they're looking at liberals. Or maybe they're looking at religion and so forth and
right.
so on.
Versus, social movements.
Hoffer says that no, all of these mass movements, these and every other sort, have characteristics that you can...
characteristics that
investigate.
Are in common. Yeah.
And moreover, the psychology of the people who join those have very strong similarities too.
Right. So that there are these characteristics in common. Now, interestingly enough, in Hoffer's preface, which is only just a couple of pages long, and in fact, one of the hallmarks of his writing is he was a very clear, precise writer, very engaging writer, and the True Believer is actually fairly slim, but most of his books were slim books. But at the end of his preface, he does put a little note about, even though he thinks that people who join mass movements and mass movements in general share certain characteristics, he says, well, it's kind of like the tomato and nightshade are in the same family, right? And here's what he says in his preface. Though one is nutritious and the other poisonous, They have many morphological, anatomical, and physiological traits in common, so that even the non-biologist senses a family likeness. The assumption that mass movements have many traits in common does not imply that all movements are equally beneficent or poisonous. The book passes no judgments and expresses no preferences. It merely tries to explain. And the explanations, all of them theories, are in the nature of suggestions and arguments, even when they are stated in what seems a categorical tone. I can do no better than quote Montaigne. All I say is by way of discourse and nothing by way of advice. I should not speak so boldly if it were my due to be believed. That's how he begins the book.
Yeah, and that brings in some interesting things, because when was the last time that a longshoreman quoted Montaigne to you?
Right, and maybe
a very interesting life.
Yeah, I was going to say, PT, let's actually talk a little bit about who Eric Hoffer was and his life before we get into The True Believer, so we can sort of frame the book. But yes, Eric Hoffer had a very interesting life, although a good portion of it, about half of it, we really have no concrete details.
We only have his word for it, and apparently his words about it changed from time
yes,
to time.
Yes, contradicted themselves and couldn't really be trusted.
But as the story goes, he was born in 1898.
Or 1902, but we think it's 1898.
Or 98. he was born in New York to Alsatian parents, despite his Bavarian accent.
Right. Well, he says they were Alsatian, yes.
And he apparently, when age 7, went blind and stayed blind until he was 15.
Right. He claims that his mother was holding him and she fell down the stairs.
Yeah.
Now, later biographers who we might talk about, Tom Bethel, who wrote a biography of Hoffer in 2012, says, can we really believe this? It doesn't seem medically possible, but this is at least the story that Hoffer tells.
Well, it's immaterial anyway. What is material is he left home, bummed around the country for a while, literally as in being a hobo.
Yes, on Skid Row.
He was in L.A. Yeah. In every town he traveled to, he apparently sat in a library and read everything they had that he could get to that was of interest to him. Right. And there was quite a lot. He wound up in San Francisco.
By 1941. So basically, he leaves New York in 1920. His mother died when he was young. His father also died when he was relatively young. He goes to Los Angeles first in 1920, where he's doing...
By a very circuitous route.
Right. By 1934, there is some good data that he was in San Diego. 1937, he submits a Social Security application in Sacramento. And then by 1941, he's in San Francisco, where he spends the rest of his years until 1983.
He does. And... he was a longshoreman until mandatory retirement at 65, and some years he spent on the docks for 3 days and over at the University of California at Berkeley the other days.
Right. Well, this is one of the things that I really like about Hoffer and his writing. You were saying at the top of the hour, PT, that... on the one hand, the true believer was picked up by more of our conservative Republican members of our country and have really seen this sort of as a book for them. And then on the flip side, you get liberals and progressive who have seen it as a book for them, especially these days. But Hoffer himself, I think, was full of, I don't even want to say contradictions. I think he was just a very authentic person. So
He was an authentic person. He was fundamentally a person who mistrusted all mass movements.
He did.
Of the left or of the right.
Right.
And so people who are involved in mass movements can sort of... cherry pick quotes out of there their particular enemies.
Right. And he was definitely anti-communist. He was he very much loved America. He was in support of many of the wars. Well, at the same time, he was a lifelong Democrat. He was a member of the Longshoremen Union. He was a supporter of the union's leader, who was a communist. So you can't really pigeonhole him.
No, you can't. His intent was to analyze mass movements without any particular regard for what they represented.
Right. So he kind of engages more in description of mass movements rather than prescription. And interestingly enough, Bethel, who's one of his biographers, the most recent one from 2012, says he approached writing Hoffer's biography in the same way. Let me describe, let me explain, but let me not really pass too much judgment. I think both Hoffer and then Hoffer's biographer leave that to the reader to determine, okay, well, so what should we do with this information? So in some senses, he's been called the longshoreman philosopher, and he's been given sort of that honorific of a philosopher and sort of a more of an ancient sense. Some people have called him the stevedore Socrates, since he was a longshoreman.
Yeah,
and
I don't think that was his intent, and I found a very telling quote from an article by Dr. Timothy J. Madigan.
Okay.
It says that in later interviews after he wrote The True Believer, he confessed that he saw himself as a potential mass leader. He had charisma, a way with words, and a cold heart toward his fellow human beings, all essential to leading large numbers of people and not caring what ultimately happens to them.
Right.
And that's... a very telling quote about what he thought about mass movements and leaders to begin with.
Right. And it's interesting, his first 40-some years of his life, like you said, we really don't have any concrete evidence about. He basically doesn't exist. He doesn't exist in passports or birth certificates. He doesn't really exist on paper. And then the second half of his life, he's very much, you know, in the public eye. He was President Eisenhower's favorite author. One magazine article in the 50s, you know, said he was Ike's favorite author. He really becomes in the public eye. And so, yeah, I could see him developing into sort of a mass movement leader, which would probably have unnerved him to the very core.
I think it would. He had a lot of familiarity with the very poor. He had lived among them.
Right.
It would have been possible. I think ultimately he felt that it would be extraordinarily dishonest, which might be another reason that he wrote the book.
Right. Now, the interesting thing is, you know, he is given this honorific of philosopher. He also taught briefly as he taught as an adjunct professor at University of California at Berkeley. So, you know, try to fit that into the pigeonhole of him being, you know, more conservative / more liberal.
Well, he did, but he also abandoned his academic career during the student uprisings in the late 60s and early 70s.
He was very critical of those student uprisings.
He was. Right. He felt that the violence there just proved what he had said in The True Believer.
Right. So when I read his book, I see him sometimes as a little bit maybe more sociologist along with philosopher. His book, The True Believer, reminds me a little of Irving Goffman's Stigma that was published in 1963. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that later in our show. P.T., I don't know, maybe we should take a quick break right now to talk with our listeners a little bit about what's going on here at WRUU before we go back to Eric Hoffer and The True Believer.
I think we need to do that.
All right. So it is Pledge Week here, or the first of our two Pledge Weeks here at WRUU, and we have some messages from some of our other hosts, and so I'm going to play those for you. But when we come back, PT and I might also add in our two cents as well.
We may.
Because you listen to WRUU 107.5 FM, we think we know a thing or two about you. How about this? We think that your social and cultural values fit closely with those that you hear expressed on WRUU. At this radio station, we value diversity, independence, and community. Our programming reflects that, so you tune in, and how about this? You're generous. We know this because every year, we tell you, our listeners, how much we depend on your financial support to keep us going. We tell you that, without your support, we wouldn't exist. And you respond with your generous donations. Tell us our assumptions are true once again. During this, our annual on-air membership campaign, we are raising the funds to bring you the programs that amplify your values. Go online today to WRUU.org and make a gift in any amount.
Supporting WRUU with your financial gift could be one of the most affordable things you do today. When you make a $10 per month donation, you're spending less on WRUU than you spend on cable or streaming services. When you make a one-time contribution of $107.50, that's less than you might spend on a pair of concert tickets and dinner for two at a nice restaurant. And you get the added benefit of WRUU lasting the whole year round. Compare WRUU to some of the other things that you value in your life, like daily coffee and your favorite snacks, and you'll discover that there are lots of reasons to value WRUU with a gift at our premium level, which works out to about 30 cents a day. Go to WRUU.org and make a financial contribution that fits within your budget. And thank you for your support of Community Radio with Global Soul.
So, PT, I know you always donate to WRUU every year, so do I. A couple years ago, we got a WRUU t-shirt, a tote bag. This year, what is the, if you're one of our serious pledgers, what is the WRUU gift?
Well, we have a tumbler. Mine in particular is dark blue. I don't know if they're all dark blue. Mine is anyway. It has the WRUU logo on it. It is insulated, so you get what you put in hot comes out hot, and what you put in cold comes in cold.
Which could be very handy with the change in our weather these days.
It is.
Yeah.
And my wife, the enchanting Miss Hamden Bridgeport, thinks it's just dandy. She loves the thing.
All right.
So it is not only a thank you gift, it is quite a useful and decorous one.
Absolutely. And our listeners can go to wruu.org to make a pledge in any amount, which we greatly thank you for. And as PT said in the last hour on Beyond the Liner Notes, we are an all-volunteer radio station around here. From the hosts to the people who keep us up and running in the back office and keep our equipment up and running, and then our listeners out there.
But that's just the people. Radio requires a certain amount of equipment and software and everything else, and that's where the money goes.
That's right. That's right. And sometimes we, as radio hosts, we try to take really good care of our equipment, but it goes through a lot of hands. So go to wruu.org if you'd like to contribute in any amount, and we love for you to continue listening to WRUU.
So please do.
PT, we were talking today about Eric Hoffer's The True Believer, The Nature of Mass Movements from 1951. And as we were saying, he really is more sort of an observer. And one of the things as opposed to writing prescriptively, or, you know, that quote that I read at the very beginning where he says, look, certain mass movements may be more tomato-like, certain mass movements may be more nightshade-like. What he was interested in was figuring out, how do mass movements come about? Why do people join mass movements? And what do they mean for society?
Right. And the conclusion he came up with, he came up with several pages of conclusion.
Quite a bit. Very readable, though.
But it starts with little or no regard for self, little or no regard for the situation the self finds himself in.
Right. Someone who is ready to join a mass movement, it's not really about self-advancement. It's actually sort of about self-abnegation, right? Self-negation.
This is somebody. Well, okay. Let's go directly to a quote.
Okay.
A man is likely to mind his own business when it was worth minding. When it is not, he takes his mind off his own meaningless affairs by minding other people's business. This minding of other people's business expresses itself in gossip, snooping, and meddling, and also in feverish interest in communal, national, and racial affairs. In running away from ourselves, we either fall on our neighbor's shoulder or fly at his throat.
Right.
And that's part of it. These mass movements, whether in the leadership role or just in a follower role, are led by very unhappy people. In many cases, the unhappiness might be economic, but it might also be psychological. It might be people who found that their life doesn't really have the meaning they hoped it would.
Right. Now, Hoffer does not mention Maslow's hierarchy of being, but one of the things he does say, though, is that most of the people who are ready to join a mass movement are not those who are struggling in day-to-day existence, those not in that sort of that dealing with the physiological needs. He says, Hoffer says, that the people who are ready to join mass movements already have quite a number of their needs met, but there's some discontent that they still have with other aspects of their lives. And so the first part of his book, when he's talking about what is the nature of the desire for change and for joining a mass movement, he says there has to be some level of frustration, right? And he says discontent is highest when misery is bearable. A grievance is most poignant when almost redressed. He also says, though, that discontent is not enough. You also have to have some power, or at least a sense that you have some power. Otherwise, why would you throw your whole self into this movement, potentially giving up your life, if you don't feel like you have the power to change? There's got to be a faith in the future and a self-renunciation of some sort. And I want to go to Hoffer's ideas about this faith in the future. And PT, in my copy of the book, it's around page 15 all the way through about page 29. He says, look, this faith in the future, you have to have the sense that somehow the present is spoiled a little bit. He also talks about how you have to have an immediate hope that the future is going to be better and a distant hope. So that when a movement first comes about, you've got to talk about that immediate hope. How are we going to make the future better now? And then once that movement kind of settles in order to keep the movement going, then you start talking about the distant hope.
You do.
How
you
to sustain do. It.
And
right?
Again, I think it's important to point out here that Hoffer was informed because of the times he lived in, not by the things we see today, but the very vigorous communism that was around that time, by Nazism,
right,
and by what was called by other people the revolution of rising expectations in developing countries. These were the people who fell into that category that he was talking about. They had finally gotten beyond being miserably poor, had gotten a taste of what it is not to be too poor, and wanted and demanded more.
Right. So he says that's the near poor or the new poor, people who weren't poor before and now are experiencing some deprivation, who tend to be most ready for engaging in a mass movement. And PT, we talked a little bit about his life at the top of the show, but you and I were talking about this beforehand. So, I mean, he lived and worked through the Depression, the Great Depression in the 1930s, as part of the WPA. Of course, he lived through World War II. He tried to sign up to serve in World War II, but was rejected because of medical reasons. And then, of course, he saw the post-war prosperity in the 1950s. And so I think all of that feeds into his ideas as well.
It absolutely does. That's what informed him. However, in what we see today, which is dramatically different, his prescriptions and analyses still hold up, I think.
They really do. And I think it's because he based this on observation and a little bit maybe on human psychology as well.
Very much on human psychology. One description of him I saw was as a social psychologist, I guess. Yes, social psychology.
Right.
I'm not sure what that means exactly, but I think that's kind of close to what he was doing. He understood the psychology of the individual, and that was very important.
Right. One of the other things he says early on in his book, in my copy around page 17, is that you also can't pigeonhole mass movements. He said mass movements tend to be of many characters rolled into one. So if you want to talk about a religious mass movement, sometimes it's a social mass movement as well, or a political one. One of the examples he gives is the Jewish exodus from ancient Egypt. You know, he says it was in part religious, in part social, in part political. And he gives various...
And they tend to do that.
Right.
In communism, it was the lack of a religion that was a religion.
That was a religion. Absolutely. And he goes on to basically point out that it's not just religion that's the opiate of the masses.
Right.
It can sometimes be, you know...
Exactly.
Yeah.
He also once said that, and this is a direct quote, Marx never did a day's work in his life and knew as much about the proletariat as I know about chorus girls. Now, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt when it comes to chorus girls, but I think I understand what he means.
Right, absolutely. Well, PT, we're at the halfway mark already, so let's take a very brief break for station identification and a few more announcements from some of our other hosts, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about Eric Hoffer's The True Believer. This is WRUU LP Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
Did you know that it's pretty much normal for community radio stations like ours around the country to interrupt their regular programming 3 or 4 times a year to conduct fundraising? Since we went on the airways in 2016, WRUU has chosen to produce these membership campaigns only once a year, in the fall. So your support now is critically important so that we can continue to bring you year-round music and talk programs without the constant need for fundraising. WRUU is a dependable source for the kind community radio that you enjoy. We need you to be dependable too. If you gave a one-time contribution last year, do so again. Consider signing up for monthly gifts. And if you haven't given yet, now is the time. Help us keep our fundraising campaign short, successful, and annual. Go to WRUU.org and support us today.
If you made a one-time contribution to WRUU last year, consider changing that to a monthly gift this year. Monthly gifts help you help WRUU. They help you by spreading out a larger gift over a year's time. $10 a month is about 30 cents a day. But it adds up to $120 of support each year for your favorite radio station. Monthly gifts are automatically renewing, and you control when they start and stop. So there's no need to remember when your year of support is up. And we can count on that support every month to bring you great radio programming. We use the Super Easy PayPal website to make the transfer from your card to our account. And you already might have a PayPal account. If not, it's one of the most trusted online money transfer methods that you can use for all types of online shopping. Go ahead and become a monthly contributor now. Find the details at WRUU.org. And thanks for supporting Savannah's best radio station, 107.5 Community Radio.
Well, welcome back to Listening to Literature on WRUU 107.5 FM. Today, PT and I are talking about Eric Hoffer's The True Believer, all the way from 1951. Now, PT, to remind some of our listeners who might now just be joining us, this book is about the nature of mass movements, how mass movements come about, why people join them, what they do in society. Now, two of the things that Hoffer says is that there has to be a sense of united action and self-sacrifice. And Hoffer said that the joining of a mass movement tends to be spontaneous, that self-sacrifice and this unity of action comes about first, even before the introduction of propaganda or coercion or persuasiveness.
Right. It seems that when people join a movement of any sort, whether it's a mass movement or just something much more benign, they accept that it's not going to be all about them. So they are perfectly willing to do some self-sacrifice. And indeed, they may feel that their lives are so flawed that they may throw them into a mass movement because they haven't been able to really build anything they like themselves. And that's kind of a sad thought.
Right. Now, again, he doesn't necessarily make any judgments about mass movements. He does provide plenty of examples. Most of them are mass movements that we would say went awry. But he intimates early on that, you know, one of the mass movements that came about a few centuries ago was the one that started the United States.
Yeah, it was. This is not to say that any mass movement is good or bad. A lot of the data he got was on things that were pretty obviously bad, but the same rules apply to things that turned out well.
Right, absolutely. So here's what he says about united action and self-sacrifice. This is on page 57. The vigor of a mass movement stems from the propensity of its followers for united action and self-sacrifice. When we ascribe the success of a movement to its faith, doctrine, propaganda, leadership, ruthlessness, and so on, we are but referring to instruments of unification and to means used to inculcate a readiness for self-sacrifice. It is perhaps impossible to understand the nature of mass movements unless it is recognized that their chief preoccupation is to foster, perfect, and perpetuate a facility for united action and self-sacrifice. Not maybe the most engaging of quotes, but it also gives you a sense of how clear his writing is. Many people have said that Hoffer tends to write in aphorisms and in these pithy sentences that aren't very, very adorned with a lot of adjectives.
He does.
Right. You can, whether you have a background in philosophy or sociology or psychology or not, you can understand Hoffer's meaning and you can see where he's coming from.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, something I feel we ought to mention about Hoffer is his writing is clear as a bell. He's wonderful with aphorisms. If you go out on the net or somewhere, you can find a ton of them.
Right.
And they're always kind of wickedly good.
Right. And we didn't mention this early on, but he has about, I believe, 10 books published. It might be 11 with The True Believer. I can't remember what the count is. But he wrote constantly. He would take these, after he'd be working, you know, as a longshoreman, he would take basically a nightly walk. You can sort of think of him as this, you know, modern peripatetic philosopher, about 3-mile walk in San Francisco, where he said that this is where he would think and think about sentences and write them down. So he has many, many notebooks. Now, some of these writings were collected by his friend / paramour, and they were donated to the Hoover Institution.
Right.
So there's a number of his writings that have not been published yet. And I don't know if there are plans for trying to go through these writings to pull together.
That would be a daunting task.
It would be very daunting.
I wouldn't want to take it on.
No, absolutely not. There are some critics who fault Hoffer for this and some who applaud him for this. But before he really gets into the meat of mass movements, so granted, it's on page 59, sort of the theories that he's bringing about, he gives readers this little sort of caveat. He says, the reader is expected to quarrel with much that is said in this part of the book. He is likely to feel that much has been exaggerated and much ignored. But this is not an authoritative textbook. It is a book of thoughts, and it does not shy away from half-truths so long as they seem to hint at a new approach and to help formulate new questions. To illustrate a principle, you must exaggerate much and you must omit much. Now, some critics have said, okay, well, he basically is saying, okay, you can't criticize me for anything that I haven't, you know, thought through.
I don't get that at all either.
I think that quote that you read earlier about Hoffer, P.T., it goes along with, I think, his personality of, you know, don't buy into this lock, stock, and barrel, just as he wouldn't want anybody to buy into anything, I think.
Well, it goes deeper than that, though. We all live individual lives, and we all have ways of working through things that are unique to us. And I don't think anybody can properly characterize anybody else's. I think it's even hard for the individual themselves to characterize it.
Right.
He was very much aware of the individual, and I find that attractive about him, even though everything he says is in a much more mass context.
But I think you've hit at the heart of this, where he's really, I think, interested in looking at the individual and individuality within society.
Exactly.
And he sees that we have to have both, right? That there's, interestingly enough, I don't know if you would call it an irony or not, but you know, when he's talking in the middle of his book about united action and self-sacrifice that comes with negating the self, he says, well, look, the capacity to resist coercion stems partly from the individual's identification with a group. So, for example, if you were in a situation like a concentration camp or very much oppressed in an oppressed member of society, he basically says, look, as an individual, you can't fight back against that, right? You actually need some solidarity with the group to help fight back against it's wrongdoing. Something. And so I don't think it's only just, oh, go out and be an individual and we only want to be individuals. I do think he sees the interesting interplay that we all deal with throughout all of our lives of how do we be individuals and also parts of groups.
And both of those are necessary. No, he's certainly not Ayn Rand.
No, yes, absolutely not, right?
If you look at some of his aphorisms, and I'm just going to pick a few here.
Okay.
People who bite the hand that feed them usually lick the boot that kicks them. And then rudeness is the weak man's imitation of strength. That one I think is particularly timely.
Very timely, yes.
And then a little more extended one. The sickened soul insists that it is humanity that is sick and they are the surgeons to operate on it. They want to turn the world into a sick room, and once they get humanity strapped on the operating table, they operate on it with an axe.
Wow. I just, yeah, you can see the power in his thinking and in his writing.
Yeah. And this to me is central to him. I think the quote I read earlier about a man is likely to mind his own business when it's worth minding, is central to him because he's dealing with people who he feels cannot mind their own business because it isn't.
Right, right. Now, part of why mass movements come about, according to Hoffer, is that you also have to sort of deprecate the present, right? You have to look at the present as somehow spoiled.
Yes, and I think anybody who's achieved any measure of adulthood understands that things aren't going to go as they imagined when they were a child. So there always is that suspicion reality isn't the way it should be.
Right. And he writes, the well-adjusted make poor profits. On the other hand, those who are at war with the present have an eye for the seeds of change and the potentialities of small beginnings. He then goes on and talks about the conservative, the skeptic, and the liberal. And he sort of says that they're actually all very similar. They all tend to cherish the present, while the radical and the reactionary are the ones who are deprecating the present and think, you know, there's got to be something better, and let's reach for it, whether through good means or not so good means.
Right. And especially in Hoffer's time, those people reach for quite complicated theories that simply did not marry up with reality very well at all, and the attempt to make them real cost many, many lives.
We were talking before the show. One of the things I like about Hoffer's perspective, he says, look, when you have an issue and you have a group on one side of the issue far extreme and a group on the other side far extreme of an issue, he says, actually, they're not the opposite. They're not polar opposites, that the extremists are actually on the same side. It's the moderates who are polar opposites to the fanatics or the radicals and reactionaries.
And again, I think you see that today in how movements imitate each other, even if they're on the opposite side of the spectrum. You see that with the some of the chance remarks that Hitler and Stalin made out about each other's
right.
techniques, and that sort of thing.
Right. And he has been criticized a little bit, basically saying that, you know, someone who joins a mass movement, sometimes they could be converted very easily to a completely different mass movement. I think there's some truth in that, but there might be some nuances we would want to pick apart. Now, here's what he says about the radicals and the reactionaries. And he puts them into two different groups, but then he eventually says, well, no, they're actually in certain ways the same. He says, wherein do they differ? Primarily in their view of the malleability of man's nature. The radical has a passionate faith in the infinite perfectibility of human nature. He believes that by changing man's environment and by perfecting a technique of soul forming, a society can be wrought that is wholly new and unprecedented. The reactionary does not believe that man has unfathomed potentialities for good in him. If a stable and healthy society is to be established, it must be patterned after the proven models of the past. He sees the future as a glorious restoration rather than an unprecedented innovation. But then Hoffer goes on and says, well, but each one of those has to either look to the future or look to the past in order to bring about their mass movements. And so he
well,
sees...
Well, in looking to the past, they're looking to a more glorious, more stable future, and mainly because they don't appreciate the problems of the past.
Right, right.
I think we've been talking about 20th century revolutions, but Hoffer looked at the French Revolution too.
Absolutely.
And I think he looked at the American Revolution
as
well. And I think he looked at some of the revolutions, successful or unsuccessful, in the 1830s and 1840s.
Right.
And saw the same things, the same characteristics happening in the people who were participating, and that's where the book came from.
Right. Now, PJ, I was going to talk with you about this before the show, but let's talk about it maybe a little bit on air.
Okay.
One of the mass movements that was around right around this time, of course, was McCarthyism.
There was. And I think... Well, okay. I don't think it was a mass movement in the sense of communism or Presbyterianism or any of the others. What it was it was an extremist view of the part of the American political system that felt that the country was full of communists, and we were being sold down the road to the communists, and people were all too people were just far too suspicious, and suspicion
is a part of
a
mass
little,
movements.
Maybe even paranoia is a part of,
that's
of
right.
what goes on in these movements. And McCarthy happened to be the acme of all these people. And even people who agreed with him to a certain extent were kind of appalled at the degree to which he took it.
Right. Now, Hoffer writes that doctrine should be judged by how thoroughly it insulates the individual from himself and the world as it is. That doctrine is not about its meaning, but its certitude, and that doctrine is supposed to be believed and not understood, and therefore a lot of doctrine might be unintelligible, vague, or unverifiable. And then he says, it is startling to realize how much unbelief is necessary to make belief possible. And on that note, PT, let's take one last break to hear from some of our other hosts who are part of WRUU. And when we come back, we'll wrap up our talk about Eric Hoffer. And then at the top of the hour, in about 12 more minutes, is Tim Hogenboom with Not Fade Away.
What would you do if you woke up one day and WRUU weren't on your radio dial? Like it wasn't even there anymore. You would not be able to find any place in Savannah to get the kind of music and news that only this community radio station brings you. Our more than 60 volunteer hosts would not be working right now to bring you hours of entertaining and stimulating programs, and your global soul would surely miss it. Thankfully, you don't have to wake up without WRUU because people just like you have made generous financial gifts to keep us going. We are listener-supported community radio, so your donation is essential to our continued presence on the air in Savannah. Go right now to WRUU.org and make a one-time or monthly contribution.
WRUU lets you set the amount that you want to give to continue receiving our product. Unlike just about every other company that you might support this week, if you like us a lot, you can give us a lot. And if you like us a little, you can give us a little. So many other media outlets are going behind a paywall, so you have no choice. We believe our product is worth $5 or $10 a month to you. We believe it's worth a one-time gift of $50 or $75 to you. Set an amount that's comfortable with your budget. The most important thing isn't how much you give, but that you give. Let us know that you value what we're doing. Let us know by setting the number. Go to WRUU.org and make a financial contribution to this radio station today.
Well, welcome back to Listening to Literature with Lee and PT. Today, we've been talking about Eric Hoffer's The True Believer from 1951. Now, PT, we only have about 10 minutes left. Later in Hoffer's book, he starts talking about the leaders of mass movements. And he does say there, you know, there are some good leaders. I think he mentions Abraham Lincoln as one. And he says, look, mass movements maybe can be good if they're short-lived. I think he thinks, at least the intimation I got from his book, is that when mass movements are very long and drawn out, then they maybe tend to be more on the not-so-positive side.
Well, that is true in some cases. A lot depends on whether the mass movement takes actual power or not.
Not, that's right.
If it takes power, and the people who are in power are committed to keeping the whole system going, then it might turn into something beneficial long term. But then you have examples like the French Revolution, which turned into a bloodbath before it became anything close to stable.
Right.
So there's that. In cases of religion, you have the very early Christians turning into the church, and then you have other mystical types who sort of the religion ended when the mystic died.
Right. Well, and Hoffer says that a mass movement basically ends when people within that movement are craving for how do we preserve the present.
Right. Right.
Right. Now, he on page 112 of his book, when he's talking about leadership, and this is a pretty interesting passage about some leaders of mass movements. Exceptional intelligence, noble character, and originality seem neither indispensable nor perhaps desirable in a leader. The main requirements seem to be audacity and a joy in defiance, an iron will, a fanatical conviction that he is in possession of the one and only truth, faith in his destiny and luck, a capacity for passionate hatred, contempt for the present, a cunning estimate of human nature, a delight in symbols, spectacles, and ceremonials, unbounded brazenness which finds expression in a disregard of consistency and fairness, a recognition that the innermost cravings of a following is for communion and there can never be too much of it, a capacity for winning and holding the utmost loyalty of a group of able lieutenants.
Right. And allied with that, in his book, The Passionate State of Mind, he said, power corrupts the few, while weakness corrupts the many.
Right.
The resentment of the weak does not spring from any injustice done to them, but from the sense of their inadequacy and impotence. They hate not wickedness, but weakness. When it is their power to do so, the weak destroy weakness wherever they see it.
Right. And he says that there has to be a passion involved in a mass movement. And he means that, I mean, he basically says, look, those individuals who have maybe a clearer idea of themselves and the world are dispassionate. But he means that in a positive way.
Yes, he does. It goes back to the sense of whether your life is worth living or not. If you think your life is worth living the way you're living it, you're much less likely to wind up in a mass movement than if you think your life is kind of negligible or even not there.
Right. And I'll go back to what I was originally starting to say about how I see this in some ways similar to Irving Goffman's stigma. Irving Goffman, when he's talking about stigma, in his book, 1963 book, Notes on the management of spoiled identity, Goffman says, look, that there aren't two groups of people, the stigmatized and the stigmatizers, that these are two social roles that we all engage in. And Hoffer does not say this in The True Believer, but I also get the same sense from his book as well, that we aren't, there isn't a group of just individuals and then a group of people who are just part of mass movements. Even though Hoffer uses the term he, when he talks about who is somebody who joins the mass movement, he does this, he does that. I think...
Well, that's mid-century
writing. Yes, right. And I will let our listeners know if they do decide to read The True Believer, there are some aspects of his language that might feel quite dated and maybe not sit so well. Maybe some of the examples may not sit so well. But for the most part, almost 70 years on now, it sort of stands the test of time. Now, PT, we only have about 4 minutes left. I have a couple of quotes from Hoffer from some of his notebooks, and apparently there are about 130 or more notebooks that, you know, where he wrote down all of these thoughts and aphorisms, and maybe one day we'll get to see more of them. But Bethel, who's the biographer, you know, says, okay, will more information about Hoffer's background turn up? That's doubtful. There are signs that he was more than merely forgetful about his early years. In fact, I believe he was deliberately secretive. When pressed for more detail by journalists, he would say he was confused or couldn't remember much of anything. About later events in his life, he had an excellent memory. Were there things he didn't want us to know? One possibility that comes to mind is that he was an illegal immigrant to this country. But again, I have no positive evidence. Did he really teach himself botany, chemistry, and Hebrew on a skid row in Los Angeles? One can't help wondering. Now, that's from Hoffer's biographer.
Right. One suspects that his study of those things wasn't exactly systematic given his environment.
No, but I do think he lives up to this Aristotelian idea and Socratic and Platonic idea of the contemplative person. He definitely was contemplative. He read quite a bit. Bethel calls Hoffer above all an original thinker and an outstanding writer. It is a precious combination. And I would agree with that. So let me give our listeners two quotes from Hoffer himself. This is from one of his later notebooks. He wrote, God has implanted in us the seeds of all greatness, and it behooves us to see to it that the seeds germinate, grow, and come to flower. We must see learning and growing as a sort of worship. For God has implanted capacities and talents in us, and it is our sacred duty to finish God's work. I think that's a lovely...
I think that's both a nice quote and perhaps a counterbalance to the attraction of mass movements.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in one of his really late notebooks, this is from 1977, Eric Hoffer wrote, practically all artists and writers are aware of their destiny and see themselves as actors in a fateful drama. With me, nothing is momentous. Obscure youth, glorious old age, fateful coincidences, nothing really matters. I have written a number of good sentences. I have kept free of delusions. I am going to die soon.
That was a part of Hoffer's career, too. He stopped teaching at Berkeley as the student riot started.
Right.
And he did so partly because the violence he saw there, as I said before, was something that he thought was part of a mass movement that he didn't want any part of. And when asked about it, he said, anybody can ride a train, but a wise man knows when to get off.
That's right. And for him, he deliberately did that.
He did that deliberately and apparently went right on writing and thinking about what he was seeing.
Right. And of course, earlier on, he had claimed that a lot of his writing happened on freight trains and trucks. And in rural areas, not necessarily in town. So he knew something about writing on freight
trains,
I think. Well,
there's writing and there's writing. Anybody who's tried to write something will tell you that ideas form best when you're nowhere near whatever you're going to write on.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Or have anything to write with.
Right.
Now, on that note, PT, I'm going to thank all of our listeners for listening to Literature here with us today. Good day and good reading. The viewpoints expressed in the preceding program were not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. This is WRUU LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.